I see a clock in the back of this church, and it's very good because I grew up in a church where the preacher told you at the beginning of the sermon what he was going to tell you, and then he told you, and at the end of the sermon he told you what he done told you. That's pretty hard for a 15-year-old to live through every Sunday. And so one day when he glanced at his notes, I was in the balcony above that clock, and I shortened his sermon by 15 minutes. It was the only time in his illustrious career that he didn't tell us again what he done told us. I assume that at 12 o'clock, if I haven't struck oil, I stop boring. Is that right? Okay. Hearty greetings from your brothers and sisters in Salzburg and around Salzburg. I'm sure that Gordy and Margaret have kept you versed over the years and what the Lord's doing there. If you'd have just come to the conference last night, you would have heard it, what the Lord's been doing there. And in fact, because I'm a guest speaker and I can get out of here and, you know, unscathed, I'm going to say, if I were you, see such a wonderful assembly, I would really do my best to be better represented by missionary focus, because that's where the focus of missions of the assemblies is. Please don't forget us all out there. You get valuable information, a network of other people. I mean, yesterday it sort of looked like back home in the geriatric ward. It'd be good if younger people, especially younger people, would come to Missionary Focus. It's only once a month. And get in tune with what the assembly missionaries from your own church and other similar churches are doing. See, I can say that and get away with it because I'm getting away. Okay? Boy, that would be important for the future of your movement. You know, we're now, the Lord's been really good to us and our co-workers that we've been training and working with over the last 35 years. And we've seen 46 assemblies started in Central Europe. And what we're desperately trying to do now, we have missionaries who go next door to Croatia or to Bosnia, is to get people where the biggest need is in the world, and that's Asia. And so we have teams going, several times a year to northern India that's been so neglected as far as the gospel goes, where we talk to people every day who've never heard the name of Jesus, and where we've seen hundreds of people saved, even as English-speaking foreigners. It's really fun. My wife and I invested $18 and bought a baptistry, a big rain barrel, a blue barrel, cut the top out of it and been baptizing people in India. We do that kind of stuff to get guys like these guys on the front row here excited about missions. And I think when a church loses that excitement, it's sort of forgotten who it is. It becomes like Cinderella with amnesia. Got a glass slipper and don't know where she got it. We were left on this earth, otherwise the Lord could have raptured us last week to evangelize it. And so I want to make a big plug for Missionary Focus. That's all right with you. And this morning, we want to talk about, we'll call this Abraham 1.0. Next week, I believe, is 2.0. And we want to begin to talk about Abraham. I know you're reading the book of Genesis. What a wonderful book. We're not very far inside it yet, but we're already over halfway through what the writer is saying. He's been telling us for 9 chapters, 3 creation stories, the creation of the universe in preparation for man. I mean man and woman. And it was good. And then the creation of man from the earth, called to till the earth, called to cultivate and protect the earth, not just exploit it. And then how man sinned, and the earth would no longer yield its produce. You see, up until that time, work was a gentleman's affair, like gardening. The difference between gardening and just hard, grueling work. And so the ground is cursed, and ultimately, Cain will be cursed from the ground. Think about it for a moment. To exist, not be able to die, to be protected by God from everybody else, and to live on this planet and miss your raison d'etre, your reason for being. I think that's the first little picture of hell we get, what it means to exist and miss out on the purpose of your existence. Then the third creation story, it's the story of man. Man and Adam and Seth in his image and humanity, and how man became a freak and God had to destroy the whole world except for one family and start out again. And that's the third creation story, chapters 5-9. And so this morning we're in chapter 10 and following. And the backdrop of the Abraham story is first the generations of Cush and what do you call it in English? Japheth, or I don't know how to say his name in English anymore. And their story and the erection of the great cities of the world. Kalne, Nineveh, Babylon, and a whole list of great cities, the beginnings of civilization. And with that backdrop, you have a family called out of the Gentile civilization, called out of the great cities. You know, I used to think growing up in Sunday school in the Baptist church, he came from Ur, you know, you are. And, you know, you are. On one side of the road sign, it says you are entering. The other side of the road sign, it says you are leaving. And they only have one post. But that was until recent days down in Samaria. Now, modern theologians and modern philologists say that can't be because the Chaldeans weren't down there at that time. But if you'll read Kitchen, he will probably convince you that the original traditional site of Ur is indeed where Abraham and co. came from. They had business dealings all the way up to Haran. And now they migrate to the north. And the writer of the Hebrews will tell us that he left a city. That's the background. The big Gentile cities with their civilizations, running water, central heating, huge libraries, because the pages of the book were that thick, you know. Centers of learning and art, which puts what we call art today to shame. He was leaving the world with everything the world had to offer and went out not knowing where he's going. That's the background. He left, and chapter 11 tells us, Terah, his great father, whose name is still remembered, at least variations of it, up in Syria, around Haran. They left, and he took his wife. We learn her name, Sarai, and we learn something about her. She's barren. And so, in chapter 11, the stage is set for the great story, not of Abraham as much as the father of the promised seed. You see, the seed was already introduced in chapter 3. The big story is not so much the father, but the seed, the descendant. And here with double vision, we see nearsightedly, perhaps, Isaac. But we can't forget what's on the horizon, the greater descendant of Abraham. And here's where the story begins, with great heathen cities. And a man willing to leave it all and go out and become a nomad. Certainly he was a great nomad prince, a sheikh. The only piece of ground he ever possessed was the grave of his dear wife, Sarah, which God is watching over till this day. He went out looking for a city. He could have returned, the writer of the Hebrews says, at any moment. He could have gone back. There were caravans leaving regularly. He could have, in the protection of other caravans, gone to the north toward Haran, taken a right, gone down southeast, down the Fertile Crescent again, to where he'd come from, to civilization. But he remained a pilgrim for all of his life because he had the expectation that God would give him something better than the best this old world has to offer. He was looking for a city. His builder was God, whose foundation was not chapter 10. Let's unite, and in our being one people with one language and one city and one tower, invincible in unity, we have our security. No. Abraham in his life, and actually pretty late in life, you'll see, in chapters 20 to 25, where the main theme is security. He'll find a security in God. He'll look for something better, as I said, than this world has to offer. And when he leaves, and we're going to read verse 12, don't worry, we'll read a verse or two, but I'm going to have to rely on your Sunday school teachers who taught you Abraham, and perhaps on your willingness to read and prepare for sermons that come on Sunday. Next week is Abraham 2.0, okay? So you can at least be prepared for next week. But I'm going to rely on your preparation because I've got so many chapters to touch this morning. Let's start with chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. God's promise to Abraham. If you take a good look at it, it's a difficult question, but probably this word is spoken to Abraham while he's still in Ur. The storyline is interrupted here. But now the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your relatives and from your country and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. The first thing he's promising is the land. Secondly, and I will make you a great nation. The second thing God is promising is descendants. Third, and I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse. He promises, thirdly, to bless Abraham, and fourthly, and in you, Paul will say, in your seed, all of the families of the earth shall be blessed. Number one, a land. Number two, descendants. Number three, blessing. And number four, that in you, all of the nations of the earth will be blessed. And that, brothers and sisters, is the rest of the book of Genesis. Because we're about to see Abraham come into the land. Verse 6, he passed through the land. Verse 7, God appeared and said, I will give you this land. Verse 10, there was famine in the land, and he left the land and went to Egypt, got booted out of Egypt, came back to the land, rebuilt the altar where he had been before, and sojourned That's just a word for living in the land. I like the word sojourn. Sometimes it's good, you can impress people with your knowledge of Shakespearean English. And then he says in chapter 13 and following, all the land that you see, after Lot had made his unfortunate choice, God says, look around. You let him have that, the best part, the profitable part, the well-watered pasture lands. Now look around to the north, to the south, to the east of the land. That all belongs to you and your descendants. You see, the first thing he's going to talk about is the land. And you know, everything that Abraham touched turned into a she-ass or a camel, a milk camel, or a sheep. I mean, everywhere he went, everything he did, it didn't turn into gold, but it turned into livestock. And our simple preachers will tell us God's Old Testament people got material blessings and we get spiritual blessings. But I hope you do thank the Lord for your food too. And I hope you don't forget that ultimately he was not interested in livestock. He was interested in the spiritual blessings of that city. But the first story is Abraham in the land and leaving the land and coming back to the land and having the land as the central factor of his promise. But what would it profit the man to gain the whole world and not to have a son to inherit it to? And so the second theme in Genesis after chapter 12 is the great theme of the descendant of Abraham. The whole question, God, you've given me all this, but I'll just have to give it to Eliezer, the oldest man born in my house. That's the law of the ancients. And so the story ensues of the promised seed. And everything Abraham and Sarah experience on the way to receiving the fulfillment of the promise in Isaac. Then the offering of the seed and his being given back to Abraham by God in chapter 22. And then the very important question, the kid is 40 years old and ain't got a girlfriend yet, you know. And so dad and mom get worried. But they've heard from a caravan that Bethuel has had a daughter and her name is Rebecca. And they get to thinking. And so this seed, you know, Abraham begins to think and he thinks, you know, well, could God do it a second time? He got me and my wife to come all the way from civilization here to the armpit of the Near East and become nomads. Could he make it happen a second time? A woman to come from among the nations, to be the bride and fellow heir of my son, who's the heir of everything that I have. Well, you know, some of you are beginning to think there's a bigger story here in the background. And so, Isaac goes in and loves his wife, as the Bible says. It's the second time love is mentioned in the Bible, of course. The first time is the love of the father for the son in chapter 22. The second time love is mentioned in the Bible is the love of that son and heir of all things for his bride who was taken from among the nations. And that finished the last verse of this section, chapter 25, verse, I don't know. It says, and God blessed Isaac. And that's the next thing. You will read, I don't know, 27 or 37 times, doesn't matter. That's pretty often the word blessing in the next big section. The next big section goes, it's the generations of Isaac. Goes all the way to the end of chapter 35. We have in 36 the generations of Esau, chapter 37, the generations of Jacob, and that's the balance of the book. And this big section, chapter 25 to 36, is all about blessing. You know it's true. That's where Isaac, he's sort of a charismatic guy. You know, he's got to be in the right mood. He has to have some good sensation in order to bless or feel blessed, you know. A good steak is, we had a steak last night. It's wonderful. Or was it last night? Yesterday. And when you eat that steak, there's a sensation to it, you know. It's not just shoveling in material to be processed. The juices flow out if you don't burn it, you know. Some people like a burnt offering on their Weber. But, you know, the juices and the sensation you have, and you thank the Lord for it anyway. It's a blessing to be able to have a good steak. My, I'm glad I'm not a Hindu. But but there's this sensation associated with it, with God's blessing. And, you know, some Christians, they can't differentiate between the sensation and the blessing itself. They're like old Isaac. He says, "Son, bring me some of that venison that my soul loveth so that I can bless you." He has to work up a blessing. Oh, there's a lot of good stuff about blessing here for modern Christians. By the way, do you feel saved? Do you have a sensation that God loves you? Well, sometimes I have more of it, and sometimes I have less of it. Please learn the lessons of chapter 25 to 35, what God has to say about blessing. Blessing is a sovereign gift of God, and blessing at the same time is something that you might have to wrestle for, as Jacob did to receive a blessing. It's a big theme. That's the third big theme of this second half of the book of Genesis. And the fourth, one in Abraham, one of his descendants, sold into slavery, innocent sufferer. He reminds us of Christ, of course, as the innocent sufferer. And not as the king. He is the administrator. He is the steward. He is the prime minister of the greatest nation in the world. Oh, where did Genesis begin? It began with an administrator, didn't it? It began with a man and a woman, and God calls the two, the pair, man, created in the image of God, made to rule over and to become God's viceroy over his creation. And man failed so miserably. And human history has been moving since that, whenever that was, toward this final story. Of all of creation, Egypt and all of its neighboring countries on the brink of ruin, starvation, and destruction, when a man, a faithful, innocent man, the descendant of Abraham, takes the reins of government in his hands, and look at creation in the hands of God's man. And you're not thinking about Joseph now, are you? I know who you're thinking about, because that's where history's moving. Yes, this is history. I'll give you that land. I'll give you a descendant. I'm going to bless you. And in you, in this descendant, I'm going to save the whole world. Isn't that a big story? I'm sort of envious that you guys are reading Genesis and I'm not. I've got to go back home to 1 Samuel, that's what we're reading. I'd love to be reading Genesis with you. What's the first major lesson this man has to learn? It's something that Jesus talked more about than faith. It's something that Jesus talked more about than hell. And he talked about hell more than he talked about heaven. It's something that Jesus talked about more than salvation. What could it be? People and possessions. You see, he got pretty rich, filthy rich, in Haran. And he comes out of Haran, and we read in chapter 12, verse 5, and Abraham took Sarai his wife, Lot his nephew, and all their possessions which they had accumulated, and the persons, the souls, you can translate that word, the lives. And so here are two things. First, possessions, and then people. Would you notice the order? And he brings all this stuff into the land. He worships God. God reveals himself to him again. And then there comes a famine in the land, verse 10. He takes his wife. He takes his family. He takes his possessions. And he goes to Egypt. And when he gets there, he says in verse 13, please say that you are my sister so that it may go well with me because of you. And please notice the conjunction. This is something different, that I may live on account of you. Two things, people. Don't mix them up. You'll miss the point. Yeah, I feel endangered having such a beautiful wife. I mean, some people, you know, I've often wondered what she ever saw in me. You know, I look like the north side of a southbound cow, but I married a beautiful woman. I guess Abraham had the same problem. And he's worried that this despot, this monarch is going to take his wife and kill him. So he's, you know, you're sort of my sister anyway, my half-sister. Say you're my sister so that it might, number one, go well with me. You know what he's saying? You know what, gal? We can earn a whole lot of money here. If you say you're my sister, I'm a made man. That is exactly what the text is saying. He's got a wrong priority between possessions and people. And if you're going to live a life of faith, that may be the first lesson you have to learn. And what did he do? Think about how she's described. She's beautiful. And she's his wife. Have before you the beauty and the sanctity of this relationship. And because he's afraid and for sordid, and really I want to underline that word, sordid gain, he denies beauty and the sanctity of his wife. You've never done that? You're in business, and it's important you have good relationships with the firm you represent and the people that are your customers. Have you never denied beauty in that and sanctity in that? You know, the most beautiful and the most wonderful, holy thing that I know is Jesus Christ. And how often, in the real nitty-gritty affairs of this life, have I sort of, it was a half-truth, or I didn't tell the whole truth, or I just didn't talk about that relationship. Of course, that's an application. That's not the interpretation. The interpretation is this. Pharaoh found out about it. You know what he did? Sure, he gave Abraham a whole lot of loot. He had she-asses and milk camels and a servant named Hagar. He picked her up in the deal. You know, that gal he picked up in the deal. And he told his officers and soldiers, you escort this man to the border of our country and kick him out. Do you know that Abraham was deported from Israel, from Egypt? Those men stood on the border until the dust of his livestock was no longer to be seen. But you know, if you've become unworthy, don't forget, as the Alcoholics Anonymous say, that was yesterday, today is the first day of the rest of your life. Every time you get out of bed, it's sort of like a resurrection, isn't it? You are asleep. That's what God calls it when a Christian dies anyway. You wake up and it's a new day. And that's what happened. He came back where he left, and he built himself an altar to God. You know, sometimes that's what God's going to call on us to do. I want you to go back where you left off, following me. And I want you to renew your relationship with me. And God revealed himself to us. And he had so much stuff, you know. He gave him sheep and oxen and donkeys and male and female servants and female donkeys. I like the King James, she asses, sometimes a good translation, and camels. And he escorted him and his wife and all that belonged to him to the border. You notice the emphasis? People and possessions. He was very rich, chapter 13, in silver and in gold. And the land could not sustain Abraham and his nephew because their possessions were very great, and so they have to part ways. Now, Abraham's about to learn, is beginning to learn something here. Lot's a good businessman. He's a better businessman than Abraham. Abraham, the great, gracious, generous man, says, Lot, you take first pick and I'll take what's left over. Now, I know what that means because my father and two of his brothers cast lots over thirds of the family farm. Whew, I know how touchy that can be. Abraham just said, Lot, you take first pick. Lot, a good businessman, a cattleman. He looks down, a dairy man, he looks down there and he sees all this well-watered plain. He thinks about possessions. He does not think about his family. Is that really where you want to live, Lot? Will you go anywhere your company says? Will you do anything to get ahead? Lot, would you consider your family? I know families even, they come to assemblies and they don't send their kids to the youth group. Why not? They've got to get ready for the SAT. Or the SATs is next year. What kind of priority is that? People and possessions and passing on this thinking to the next generation. Or people who've compromised and gotten themselves into situations and lost their families as Lot did for business reasons. Oh, we'd be very careful. God's facing us with that this morning. If you don't believe it here, you read the Gospel of Luke. You read the Gospel of Matthew. As a young Christian, I'd start reading one thing, but I'd better read another one, and it'd get worse in the next one. Because God was speaking to me on this issue. Lot made his choice. He pitched his tents towards Sodom. Eventually, we'll find him living in Sodom. And finally, we'll find the attitude of the Sodomites toward him, the attitude of his own unbelieving sons-in-law towards him, and finally, the attitudes of his daughters, his wife. He lost his wife, and his daughters named his children from father. Terrible thing when your son is really your grandson. Bad choices. You know, everybody in this room, except for some of us, I mean, all of us really, we're going to be defined by the choices we make, by the priorities we have, what we put first in our life. Will it be people or will it be things? People love things and use people when in reality they should love people and utilize things. So Sodom Abraham, Lot goes to Sodom, and when Lot's out of the way, you know, his camels are disappearing. That's the last thing you see with Lot, is the rear end of a camel. And God says, okay, Abraham, that's settled. He says, Abraham, I want you to come out with me and take a look around. Lift up your eyes from this place, verse 14, where you are, northward, southward, eastward, westward, for all the land which you see, I give it to you and your descendants forever. Your descendants will be as the dust of the earth. And so Abraham moves his pilgrim camp, and he builds and he calls upon the name of the Lord. He builds an altar. Then we have the kings, you know, the decision of Lot. He couldn't see the future. You can't either. That's why it's important to say, you know, if the Lord wills and we still living. Lot didn't ask the Lord, where should I go? Lord, what do you want me to do? God's going to have reserves that for Abraham. Lot makes his own choices and becomes chattel, carted away by the kings. Abraham, he's got a few hundred guys working for him, born in his house. A real army in the terms of a Bedouin king. He marshals his forces. He hears that his relative had been taken captive. He marshals his forces. He brought back all the goods. And he also brought back his relative Lot and his possessions, and also the women and the people. Now, how does that make you feel, women? First of all, there's the goods. Then there's Lot and all of his possessions, and also the women and the people. See the priorities here? And here he comes to the second greatest temptation in his life. A man, his motto was probably, you know, money don't stink. This is the first of all Jewish people, okay? And, you know, this guy, up until now, everything is about money and possessions, and that's the important thing. And here is the chance of a lifetime. He's got all this stuff. The possessions, and also the people. And he sees the king of Sodom coming. And the king of Sodom, you know, in the words of the Godfather, is going to make him an offer he can't pass up. He's going to say, you can have all the goods. I just want the people. Enter Melchizedek. Now, I'd love to have time this morning to dance with you through the book of Hebrews and show you how Paul studied the Bible. Oh, I'm sorry, the writer to the Hebrews. I almost said Paul. Studied the Bible, because he will take this passage and he will interpret it for several chapters, and of course with a parallel passage, the most quoted Old Testament passage in the whole Bible, Psalm 110. I'm going to lay it out there for you, but I'm not going to do that. What I'm going to do is go back to Abraham, because see, when we read the scripture, our first responsibility as teachers of the word is to stay at the historical level. And then it's sometimes funny to sort of mention a New Testament word or phrase, and the people say, wow, that's the way it is with Christ too. But stay with the first level. I want to tell you about the first level. This man, he is already inventoried. He's been on the way since Damascus with all this stuff. He knows exactly how many cattle he has. He knows exactly how many changes of garment he has. He knows exactly how much gold and how much silver and how many people. And suddenly, as though he were beamed down from Starship Enterprise, I know you're too young to know that. Some of us old guys do. Enter Melchizedek. So suddenly, that the New Testament writer says, it's just although he had no beginning and no end of days and no father, no, they're not mentioned. He's just there. And his name is the rightful king. Okay, that's certainly what his name was. But it can also, with a little sleight of hand, be translated the king of righteousness. He's the rightful king, the king of righteousness. Also the king of Salem, the king of peace. Notice the order, righteousness and peace. The prime minister of England, of Great Britain, what was his name? Tony Blair said in the Irish question, we're not interested in justice. We want reconciliation. Sounds like Jimmy Carter. God's not that way. You'll never have peace without righteousness. And what did the man do? Here's where we want to end this morning. He does what every priest does. And I got an inkling of it at the breaking of bread. I hope you were there, because if you weren't, you were like Thomas. We were together and the Lord appeared and you weren't there. You missed him. And I got an inkling of it this morning in the words of my brethren. The priest shows the people how God really is. They see God as they never saw him before. You know what it means to glorify God? It doesn't mean to say certain words and say them loud. To glorify God means to change how people see God. They see him in the majesty of holiness, his mercy. And this priest, who knows what a priest has to do, he comes and he says to Abraham, Abram, the man who's so often had the wrong priority, he says to him, blessed be Abraham of the Most High, of God Most High, the possessor of heaven and earth. He brings him some wine. He brings him some bread. I mean, if you're hungry and you're irritated. I mean, it's a dangerous group, the Weight Watchers, when they have a bad week. He's bringing something, sustenance. He's beginning to get some equilibrium. His blood sugars are leveling out. And he says to him, okay, buddy, don't forget who you are. Never forget who you are. Please, young person, never forget who you are. Like a Reuben who was the firstborn and went up to his father's bed. And never forget who God is. Abraham, you rich guy. Everything you touches turns to money. But you are Abraham of the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth. And when Sodom's king comes and makes his proposition, notice how Abraham rephrases the words of the priest. Abraham said to the king, he says, give me the people and you take the goods for yourself. And Abraham answers after this priest who comes in a nick of time. Where do you read that in the New Testament? Isn't that Hebrews? He's right there when he needs to be. He says, sir, I just wanted to say, I have sworn to the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth. I'm not going to take a nickel or a dime off you. And what happens after that? God appears afresh to Abraham. He says, you know, Abraham, I'm a shield to you and your reward is very great. I like the other alternate translation. I think it's actually better. I am your very great reward. We sing in German, was wäre der Himmel ohne dich und alle Herrlichkeit? What would heaven be with all its glory without you? God is our very great reward. If you don't have a pot to spit in. And you've got God. You've got the possessor of heaven and earth. And your very great reward. Please, I see young people here. I see fathers, I see mothers. I didn't even get to the central lesson of the text, chapter 15, how you get justified. But maybe that's enough for this morning. The decisions you make in this world concerning possessions and people will be perhaps the most important decisions you ever make.
No, I'm